U.S. military presence in regions like the Middle East and Asia, East Asia, is fundamentally a destabilizing presence. Like, there's a baseline sort of like maxim in American foreign policy thinking that wherever you put military forces, you get greater stability. I'm convinced the exact opposite is true.
Well, welcome to Radius of Reason, a show about the greatest interconnected problems facing humanity. I'm Levon with my co-host, Andre. Today's guest is Mark Kukas. He's a professor of government history and journalism. He covered the Iraq War for Time magazine, and he's a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute.
With the election of Donald Trump, we had Mark on the show to talk about the coming foreign policy of the second Trump administration. We get into how to resolve some of the collective action problems on the international stage. And given Mark's experiences as a journalist, we also talk about the state of the media industry and what this all means for American society. So, Mark, tell me, are you worried about what American foreign policy is going to look like under the second Trump administration?
Yeah, fairly concerned. I mean, in the first Trump administration, we saw, a number of things, but to me, the most dramatic and worrisome moment was when the Trump administration assassinated General Soleimani in Baghdad. So, and in that case, it sort of, you know, when you look at the reports of how that decision came about, it to me was indicative of troubling behavior. So the way these things tend to work is that, you know, the U.S. intelligence apparatus will keep a list. They'll be keeping tabs on various people who they might want to retaliate against. Soleimani was on that list, and they were given, my understanding from reading the reports is that they had a beat on him in Baghdad. And so when that happens, they'll go to, and this is true for, you know, all governments have a list of people that they wouldn't mind killing. And all governments, any government that's heavily involved in sort of like military affairs.
Yeah, like Costa Rica hit list.
Of course. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, like there's probably a number of governments that don't involve themselves in assassinations, but many do. Or targeted killings, I should say, however you want to, whatever term you want to use.
Yeah, the politically correct the term for assassination.
Yeah, exactly. But the way it tends to work is that, you know, intelligence agents will keep an eye on people that they wouldn't mind killing. And then when opportunities arise to take a shot, they'll present those options to the president, and the president can say either yes, let's do it, or no. And so the president was the reports made clear that Soleimani appeared in Baghdad, and the intelligence community came to the president. The White House was like, hey, we think we got a beat on him. What do you want to do? And there are options. You know, like you could have like reprimanded the Iraqis for letting him be so public in the Capitol. You could have done nothing. And instead, in that situation, Trump chose the most extreme option, which was to assassinate him. And so a very much an escalation. And look, you know, it's not like, there were reasons why the United States sort of would want to kill an Iranian general dating all the way back to the American occupation of Iraq, mm-hmm. and the Quds force and Iranian paramilitary forces and American military forces have a long history of conflict. And so it's not like, you know, there was a, it's not like they sort of like were killing a, you know, peace activist or something. but at the same time, it was an escalation, right? There were ways to handle that situation that did not involve escalation. And that escalated, we're very lucky we didn't wind up in a direct war with Iran in that moment, right? I mean, when I saw that news and I was a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute, I immediately was just like, we're going to wind up in a war with Iran, maybe ground forces, at least in part of Iran. I mean, I really felt like there was that the cascade of events was really going to unfold. And we're lucky in a situation like that, or in that situation, I should say, where things de-escalated. Both sides sort of like stepped away from the brink. But the fact that Trump was willing to take a sort of like an extreme, impulsive, escalating action in a moment of key decision, to me, you know, plus all the other erratic behavior that is, mm-hmm. that Trump has exhibited and the people around him have exhibited, sort of suggests that, you know, moments like this are not going to be handled with a lot of thoughtfulness and care. And there's multiple areas in American foreign policy where tensions have begun to run very, very high, you know, in Taiwan, in the South China Sea, in multiple spots in the Middle East now. And it seems like there's a recipe for a lot of conflict and confrontation, where you have high tensions and a leader with a demonstrated pattern of erratic behavior.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the conversation, don't forget to hit the subscribe button.
And leave us a comment. Let us know what we could be doing better.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of the biggest point that I wanted to bring up is there's a stark difference in the two administrations, Trump 1.0 and Trump 2.0, and that, largely speaking, the foreign policy context of 1.0 was really defined by the continued American presence in Afghanistan. But we've pulled out of Afghanistan, and now he's inheriting a foreign policy that has the largest land war in Europe since Yugoslavia happening between Russia and Ukraine. You have the Israel-Gaza situation, which seems to only continuously escalate and spill over to Lebanon, spill over to Yemen. So he's inheriting like a very, very difficult situation. And there has been this narrative that Trump ran as like the peacenik candidate, that he's going to, you know, stop all these wars and, you know, pull America out of all these like foreign involvements that we still have. Is there a chance for that? Do you see any symptoms of that in his cabinet appointments, for instance?
No, I mean, and I've always found this narrative of Trump being the sort of like a force for peace and stability to be kind of just not really believable. I don't think you can point to any instances where you've seen Trump, you know, sort of really make forceful efforts for peace. Like, where has Trump sort of, when has Trump organized a peace talk?
I suppose North Korea is probably the best example that we have.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps. I just don't buy it, though. I feel like that is sort of part of a, I feel like that's sort of, you know, just political rhetoric and political branding. And I think if you look at the substance of the actions of the Trump administration, what you see is antagonistic behavior in multiple areas of foreign policy, on trade, on security, on immigration, on environmentalism. Mm-hmm. Right. It's right. It's the general go-to approach is confrontation and antagonism for allies and adversaries alike. So I just don't buy that narrative. And I just don't think that there's really much of a chance for any substantive substantive movements for peace in virtually any areas.
And I mean, if you were in a position of advising Trump at this point, if you're appointed to the cabinet, which you might be, you know, who knows, we might be talking to, you know, a future Trump administration power mind here. But I mean, what kinds of counsel would you provide? You wrote an article at the start of the Biden presidency to kind of urge Biden to step away from the Carter Doctrine, to move away from this kind of armed protection of American energy interests in the Persian Gulf. What sorts of prescriptions would you offer up at this point to a new incumbent president, given what we talked about in terms of the flashpoints that we're facing?
So, I mean, I think that the first thing, I mean, if I were like advising Trump as like a counselor to the president or something, which is I struggle to imagine that as the case. But what I would say is, I think I would first sort of recognize that Trump has at least, he's publicly stated that he wants to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
Right.
And he seems to think, right or wrong, that he has the ability to play a peacemaker there. So the first thing I would say to Trump is, and that to me is like, that's positive. It would be great if that conflict could come to an end. And so if Trump feels like he can play a positive role in that, I would say like, hey, the conflict is basically stalemated at this mm-hmm. point. And the longer it's stalemated, the worse it gets for everybody. Mm-hmm. Certainly the worse it gets for Ukraine, the worse it gets for Russia too. So when this conflict ends, I'm also convinced that just because of the way the fighting is shaped up on the ground, that there's not really a possibility for one side or the other to come away with a decisive victory. So only a political settlement is really sort of the optimal thing out. Otherwise you get endless conflict. You get sort of like an India-Pakistan kind of like, you know, going on and on and on and on, and that is just destructive. And it's destructive for the societies. It's destructive for the infrastructure, and it's destructive for the politics of the region. And if you can avoid that outcome, basically endless conflict, you really should. So I think there's actually an opportunity there. If Trump's willing to invest, and he has a connection to Putin, and they're willing to sort of like, you know, do something about this, then I would urge, like, find a peaceful settlement for Ukraine. Do everything you can. And it has to be handled carefully because, I mean, in my own opinion, you know, you don't want a peace deal. You don't want to sort of like forge a peace deal that sort of really shortchanges Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It has to be a peace deal that makes sure that Ukraine's integrity and sovereignty and its losses are recognized, and it has to be something workable for them. So you don't want to just have a peace deal that sort of like winds up sort of cementing the status quo of a Russian aggression. So it would be a hard peace deal to make, but that's what I would urge to focus the most energies. And then in the other areas where there's security issues and military conflict in the Middle East, I still stand by the recommendation to demilitarize the U.S. presence in the Middle East. That's much harder to do now for a variety of reasons, which we can unpack. But the basic, I'm 100% convinced that U.S. military presence, I mean, having looked at this for as a journalist and as a scholar for more than 20 years now, that U.S. military presence in regions like the Middle East, in Asia, East Asia, is fundamentally a destabilizing presence. Like there's a baseline sort of like maxim in American foreign policy thinking that wherever you put military forces, you get greater stability. I'm convinced the exact opposite is true, that where you put sort of military forces, you get instability. You incite conflicts, you disturb regional balances that could sort of potentially cohere in alliances that are more stable than having an interventionist force sort of lurking around and actively involving itself in conflicts. So fundamentally, I think the Middle East would be a more peaceful place without the U.S. military presence or a dramatically reduced military presence. In my mind, the best way for the U.S. military to be helpful in the Middle East is to reduce itself to an entirely a naval mission that keeps in cooperation with militaries of the region, including Iran, to make sure that the oil flows productively from the oil fields to the world economy, and that there's not sort of overt militant activity sort of disrupting the politics. I think that can be done with the militaries of the region to include Iran, and then you don't have to have massive air bases and massive military bases. So withdraw the troops, reduce the military presence in the Middle East to a minimal level that revolves around a multinational naval mission. Try to go for peace in Ukraine. And then when it comes to Asia, it's time to start de-escalating. It's time to start like arms reduction talks. Mm-hmm. It's time to sort of have a big sort of like inclusive sort of conference where China is brought to the table and everybody agrees that like no one wants the war that everybody seems to be thinking about and talking about all the time now. We've seen a massive arms buildup in Asia for more than 15 years across the Obama administration and the Trump administration, and then now the Biden administration. So it's the situation has become it's become a tinderbox. It should have never gotten to this point. And there's plenty of reasons to de-escalate. But there hasn't been political leadership on the part of the United States to be like, hey, we recognize that this is too volatile and this is too dangerous. We want to sort of take steps to find a peaceful path away from the conflict we seem to be all preparing for these days.
But it's almost like it's become like a ingrained nature of maybe the American experience that we are deployed somewhere at some point. I mean, the Middle East, Christ, like for the better part of our adult lives has been inflamed in some sort of conflict where it's almost just become like just as American to go out and vote in November. Yeah, we're fighting a war somewhere. Kind of the perpetual slog of conflict after conflict after conflict. How much of this is just part of like our political psychology that we're constantly deployed somewhere, that we're constantly boots on the ground, surrounded by military bases without really much question coming from the polity?
I mean, it's everything. I mean, the whole reason why why American interventionism has been able to sort of go on and on and on at such a large scale, you know, basically from the Cold War to now, and particularly sort of like, I mean, American interventionism continues to be at a very large scale in places like Africa, mm-hmm. obviously in the Middle East. And the lack of questioning of that in American politics revolves around this idea that American economic prosperity is directly linked to military activities abroad. The fundamental logic is that, you know, we need access to markets. And we can only have access to markets if there's regional stability. Our military provides regional stability wherever it goes. That's the baseline logic, and that is an accepted kind of, you know, paradigm by most of the populace. Meanwhile, it's also important to note that our society is generally militaristic. You know, it's a violent society. You know, there's a reason why we have, you know, school shootings and many other countries don't. You know, there's in general, sort of what you see in America when you compare it to other, say, OECD countries, is that there's just a lot of violence here. And there's a lot of militarism and people sort of like exalting the, you know, sort of like military strength and savoring in sort of things like aircraft carriers and cruise missile strikes and the like. So, you know, it plays well with this kind of really kind of overdeveloped sense of militarism in the United States. And that's something that is like, if you look at the history of militarism in the United States, what you find is that it hit its kind of low point after the Vietnam War, and then gradually sort of like militaristic sentiments began to build and build and build, sort of like came back in and kind of like full kind of, you know, force in the 1991 Persian Gulf War and remained high ever since. And they've been dented a little bit by the U.S. experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq, but not that much. You know, there's still a lot of appetite, you know, in the domestic polity for confrontations in the Middle East, in, you know, Asia.
But our involvement in these conflicts, though, I mean, surely someone is actually benefiting, right? It may not be the average citizen, but somebody is benefiting. So the question is, like, who's benefiting, and what role also, like, are all these resources playing in these various conflicts? Because surely they are. So if you were to break it down.
I mean, the benefactors of the, I don't want to overly generalize, because the dynamics of conflict in Ukraine are different than the dynamics of conflict in the Middle East, are different than the dynamics of conflict over Taiwan. I mean, but for instance, you know, in like Taiwan, we have had, you know, what boils down to a promise to defend them against China, and that's been a sort of informal promise. And in South Korea, there's a formal promise, like, we will defend you against North Korea. Like, and so those are commitments that the nation has made. And that's different than inserting yourself in a region like the Middle East, where no one has asked you to come.
You know, in fact, they've asked you to leave multiple times.
Exactly. You've been asked to leave multiple times over many decades. And you're like, no, we will stay because we've appointed ourselves as the world guarantors of the oil in your lands. And so, and that's just different. You know, those are different conflicts or different types of conflicts. And so I don't want to overly generalize. But what I would say is that the militarism in the United States is, the benefactors of U.S. domestic militarism are the government. The government just generates a lot of its own sort of activities through pursuit of military missions, weapons programs, and keeping a massive military and the like. And that sort of translates into a lot of jobs around the country. And so, I mean, a good example of this is aircraft carriers, right? So aircraft carriers at this point are either they're obsolete or on the verge of obsolescence as weapons because of anti-ship missiles. And they just keep, we keep building them. And
how do you square this with, you know, some of your writing where you say the modern wars actually weaken nations? Because here it seems like you're saying that that involvement generates kind of an economic boost, but so it seems like there's maybe a bit of a contradiction there, or maybe I'm not misunderstanding you fully.
And then in terms of like, when most of what I've looked at in terms of modern warfare is how what political scientists teach between interstate warfare and intrastate warfare. And so most of what I looked at is intrastate warfare, wars within states. So where like multiple armed groups are fighting within a state, and then those armed groups wind up attracting benefactors from outside
like the
country.
Spanish Civil War or the Syrian Civil War.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or, you know, when you look at, say, like, you know, like Iraq, an American occupation of Iraq, right? You've got sort of like an insurgency, you've got Iranian operatives, you've got the American military.
The Kurds.
Syria's probably the best. Yeah, Kurd, exactly. And so Syria's probably the better example now, or the war in Yemen, right? So like the war in Yemen has attracted intervention from Iran and intervention from the neighboring countries, intervention from the United States. I mean, that conflict is truly multidimensional. I mean, meanwhile, amid the civil war in Syria, sorry, in Yemen, you have an ongoing counterterrorism operation by the United States. The United States will periodically hunt down Al-Qaeda operatives. And so it's a war within a war.
Right.
And so those conflicts are primarily what I've looked at, and those conflicts degrade countries pretty significantly. Countries that sort of like base their economy on production of war equipment, right, which is basically what a large part of the U.S. economy is. I mean, the U.S. economy is huge, and it's not like we only make sort of like war materials, but a lot of what we do is make war materials. The latest arms is the reason why we're the latest arms exporter.
No, and I mean, you alluded to a really interesting conundrum, right? Where it's almost like everything you're describing in terms of your prescriptions to potential Trump foreign policy in drawing down and maybe focusing on coalition building in particular regions of the world. I think it makes 100% like logical sense. Even on a human scale, it's more of a humane approach, and it would end so much suffering, I think, in that particular region in the Middle East. But there is the conundrum, right? Where if you start drawing down American force presence, if you start engaging in arms reduction talks with China, it is going to have an impact on an economy that, to your point, has been very much stimulated and driven by weapons production. The deindustrialization of the Midwest was like one of the greatest, I think, economic crises of the late 20th, early 21st century. And entire towns in the Midwest have been reinvigorated because the global war on terror demanded arms production, demanded missile production. You referenced aircraft carriers, the F-35 fighter platform. All of the manufacturing for this does keep entire communities afloat. I know towns in Missouri where if there wasn't like the local bullet factory, well, I mean, it would be back to complete economic crisis. So simultaneously, yeah, okay, like you're saying very logical things about the need to draw down, but what would be the unintended aftershocks on like a domestic scale? Like, would it even be supported at the level of, you know, local house races if a candidate voted for, a drawdown of forces in the Middle East, but it's going to lead to direct economic consequences to the community they're representing? So is it even in the interest, I guess, of American democracy to engage in a more rational, maybe agreement-driven foreign policy?
So, I mean, no. I mean, it's not sort of a part of it would be counterintuitive to the economic logic of the country to sort of shut down industries that are supporting communities. But at the same time, it's been done before, right? There was demobilization and it happened. And like, you know, it's like you can change your economy, you can shift your economy. Is it easy to do? No. Is it possible even? Because like you say, you know, if the United States, you know, if the Trump administration says tomorrow, we're going to cut defense funding by, 60%.
Yeah, that's right? The real intention of the Elon Musk government, Department of Government Efficiency, right? They're going to be slashing defense budgets.
No, it's really clear. It's really clear where a lot of money goes that could be spent in other ways. I mean, even people, and it's not just sort of like, academics like me, people within the Pentagon will tell you that there's plenty of waste and ways to save money. People in the Pentagon would tell you that we're spending too much on too many resources on overdeveloped missions in Asia and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. It's not, there's plenty of military thinkers who would agree with this. Mm-hmm. And there's not many military thinkers that sort of, I think, would go as far as I would go in terms of like taking the risks of a drastic reduction of military forces in the Middle East or taking the risks of a drastic military reduction in Asia. There's an honest debate to be had about whether that's wise in terms of security, but there's plenty of military thinkers who would say, look, we can scale this down. Can you do that domestically? I don't know. I think that, look, the short answer is it doesn't seem so. Because when you look at any number of congressional races in the House and the Senate, what you find is that they're enmeshed in sort of allocation of pork barrel politics from the defense industry. And so it would be very, very, very hard. The process would have to be, we'd have to start at the presidential level, where they would make some strategic decisions about sort of reductions in whatever areas, force reductions around the globe, reductions of, you know, munitions in the United States. And then you would have to systematically pursue that with some gradualism that didn't lead to massive economic dislocation. It didn't lead to political disruption. It would have to be a gradual withdrawal. But it could be done, right? And there was a window for this sort of like after the, you know, the killing of Osama bin Laden and after the withdrawal of forces from Afghanistan, you could say like, hey, we're done. You know, there was even like there was this moment, if you go back to the Obama administration, we're like, we're going to do the pivot to Asia. So we thought then that we could more or less sort of like move out of the Middle East, stop fighting these wars and concentrate on, you know, essentially a broader geopolitical problem in Asia. So there's the Obama administration and then the Trump administration and the Biden administration all agreed on the pivot to Asia, which meant basically sort of like turning away from the Middle East. That's become a lot more complicated, of course, but you can sort of like shift the public sentiment away from military missions. The process for this is narratives from public leaders who say like, the time of war is over. You know, it's time for all these heroes who fought bravely to sort of go back to their families and their communities and start, you know, moving on with a different kind of life. And it's not easy, but societies have done it again and again. Demobilization. There's a playbook for this. Does it mean sort of escaping economic pain? No, there's economic pain, but the pursuance of militarism and pursuance of interventionism leads to so many problems and so much wasteful allocation of resources.
And I think this is kind of, it's something that we've talked about in previous episodes where it does seem that even if the things we're talking about are totally logical, and if we understand like the pain and destruction and like absolute worsening of circumstances for all these sorts of interventions bring about, yet we're still partaking in them because Rome was kind of captured in like a self-perpetuating system. The same could probably be translated over to things like climate change, where, I mean, okay, not everybody acknowledges that it's real. That's a separate conversation. Levon recently had a trauma where like a hotel he was supposed to be staying at burned to the ground. So he's like very aware, well, burned to the ground because of forest fires. So now he's like, you know, very woke to the notion of the doom of climate change that's coming. But I'd say, I don't know if I can even say the majority of people, but let's just say for the sake of conversation, the majority of people recognize that something is happening with climate patterns that is posing an existential risk to us as a civilization. Storms are getting stronger. Coastlines are flooding. Shit, I mean, even insurance companies aren't even like underwriting policies on the West Coast in some parts anymore because of, you know, the potential for flood damage. But nothing is really being done to change it because we're kind of captured in this kind of cyclical system, maybe intertwining economic and political interests that really kills the will to change anything.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like a game theory dynamic. And, you know, I think from a military standpoint, if the U.S. withdraws, you know, someone comes to fill that vacuum. And then now do they have better trade deals as a result, access to better resources? And, you know, the entire like neoliberal paradigm is based on like growth, right? And it's the reason why I think, you know, they started the whole like globalization thing is because growth was slowing down kind of at the local level and they needed to expand to get more resources. But we know that growth is a totally absurd, unsustainable like premise, but that underpins the entire global economy. And so as resources start to dwindle, because they will, whether you think it'll happen in the next, you know, 20 years or the next 50 years, whatever, but you know, some people think we've reached peak oil, all that, but you know, ultimately they will dwindle. And then the question is like, are we going to see more resource wars as a result of this just complete adversity to try to create an economy that's actually circular and sustainable as opposed to based on a very, very faulty premise?
I mean, I think the short answer to that is yes, unless minds change, and minds can change. So we live in a world now where many, if not most people, recognize that the environment is strained to a breaking point and needs to be tended to pretty seriously with policy changes and economic changes. There's really, really slow progress on that. And it's super frustrating for everybody who sort of sees, you know, things like, you know, hotels where they stayed at burning down and other signs that this is like this doom is actually sort of like materializing right before our eyes. But it's also important to take a step back and like go back to like the 60s and 70s, go back to even like the 80s, go back to even like the 1990s when Al Gore was like a voice in the wilderness talking about climate change, you know, like minds have changed. There used to be zero recognition of this threat in American society on a global level. And now we live in a world where almost everybody recognizes it, right? And even if you don't believe it, you have to defend your beliefs against that, right? It's not like you can sort of like wave it away anymore. That's a whole huge shift in thinking. And it's been brought about by a steady sort of parade of thinkers and leaders who have said again and again, this is a problem. We have to start dealing with this. This is a problem.
It's a start. But then all the people that have power right now, like, for example, in the U.S., you know, we're electing an administration that thinks it's a hoax, that, you know, their slogan is drill, baby, drill.
That's right. Yeah.
And yet, even if that wasn't the case, all the incentives are still for all nations are aligned such that they're not really going to do much to battle climate change, because that's going to put them at an economic/military disadvantage. I think what we, like Andre and I, have talked about in the past is, well, you need some sort of international coordination, some sort of treaty to change those game theory dynamics. And we talked about, like, okay, if you were to reform the UN, what would that look like? And actually, I saw on the Quincy Institute, they had this Better Order project where they talked about different, it was a proposal to more or less reform the UN. And I thought it was pretty interesting. Can you talk to us about what are some of the ways that we can try to change international institutions to make some of these great like coordination challenges a little bit easier to work on?
I'm not hopeful that international institutions can function with a lot of effectiveness if the United States remains at odds with them. So, you know, the Paris Agreement is a perfect example of this. The Paris Agreement is one of the most important international agreements to ever come about. And it's really hard to get anything done if the United States leaves it. It's just hard. The world's biggest economy is just not going to participate. And it's just really difficult to conceptualize ways to meet those benchmarks. During the Trump administration, there was this sort of like a movement by like leagues of cities. So like, you know, like mayors of cities around the country were like, hey, the United States at a federal level pulled out of the treaty, but we feel like just in our localities, we can help the country meet its emissions benchmarks if we just get organized with our own regulatory system. And essentially sort of like, kind of like federalize the process. Mm-hmm. And sort of like we're committed to the Paris Agreement, even if Washington is not, and we're going to try to reduce emissions. And what they found over that was that they could make some headway, but there was really no replacement for leadership at the federal level in the United States. It's just too hard to make progress on such a big problem without that. And so on many other issues, it's like this in my understanding of international relations. So global institutions, the United States, for better or for worse, and plenty of people would say for worse, remains the most powerful country economically and the most powerful country militarily. And so when international institutions are directly at odds with the United States, it's just really hard for them to get things done because their member nations wind up sort of conflicted about how to work with one another and maintain strong relationships with the United States. And then the United States has ways of undermining the agendas of these institutions. So I don't feel like international institutions, unless the United States is really bought into them, have much of a chance of being more effective.
Do you think any of that could change? You know, there's a lot of writing right now that we're witnessing the early stages of a return to a multipolar world order, right? Where power isn't in fact just concentrated in the US, and it is distributed more, probably shifting more to like a bipolar spectrum with China really carrying a lot of influence specifically through all of its infrastructure projects it's working on. But the fact that, and it, maybe it's not a fact, if power is indeed shifting away from a centralized global order that's largely dictated by the US, does that offer up the chance for kind of a reinvigoration of international collaboration to address some of these issues? As in, if the United States continues to go along the trajectory it's currently on, continues not to play ball with these sorts of institutions, but let's say if China or for whatever reason BRICS decide to kind of exercise a little bit more international clout, could you drive international collaboration without the presence of the United States in the fold?
Potentially, if a country like China were in the lead, say, for example, China were to host a regional security summit and not invite the United States.
Jesus. Yeah.
It sounds ludicrous, but then if you just like, wait, why wouldn't they? You know, like, it's a regional security summit and we're going to invite Japan, we're going to invite South Korea, we're going to invite Vietnam, we're going to invite Australia, but we're not going to invite the United States because we consider you an intrusive military presence and we consider you a destabilizing factor.
Yeah, AUKUS suppose bros all those are... just can't handle it. They're just...
Yeah, exactly. So imagine a world where that happened. I mean, in other countries, like, imagine Japan and China having, say, for example, bilateral security.
Oh, Christ. Yeah, I mean, it's burying the hatchet, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not inconceivable, and I think it can happen, but it can only happen if countries are willing to truly exclude the United States. And when you look at the confrontation between the United States and China, it's very different than obviously the confrontation that the United States and the Soviet Union faced, because China's economy and America's economy are so heavily interwoven. So there was virtually no economic connection between the Soviets and the Americans during the Cold War. But there's all kinds of economic connections between these two. So the idea that China could make, you know, the country that is positioned probably most advantageously to lead international efforts, excluding the United States, is China. But it's difficult to imagine them doing so, because even them, the strongest of the countries that could sort of, like, you know, with the potential political will and ability to face down the United States on any given question, they're still so interwoven economically with the United States, right, that it's difficult to imagine like really big departures.
Right. And I wanted to get back to the point you were making about there. I like thinking about international collaboration with the United States still playing a role in things. I mean, something about us being ostracized, like, I don't know, like East Germany or something, doesn't quite bode well for, I guess, our political future. But okay, so there needs to be some sort of change in mindset within our leadership, maybe within our greater kind of political consciousness as citizens of this country. Do you think there's any hope for kind of grassroots movements to sort of influence this sort of change? I mean, you referenced the Trump era kind of city approach to try to maintain climate commitments, but didn't quite pan out because there wasn't support from like the political nerve center. Is grassroots activism and organizing a possible solution to addressing some of these various kind of intertwining problems we're facing on the international stage?
I don't think so. And my hope for that was really broken in the run-up to the war in Iraq, when if you sort of like go back in time, and it became clear that even before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, that their justifications really were not very convincing. The evidence was flimsy. There was plenty, despite all of the sentiment for the invasion, there was lots of people who were like, this is not a good idea. The evidence is not compelling, you know, which led to the most prominent critics of it were, you know, Germany and France, who refused to sign on to it. And meanwhile, there was a massive grassroots movement, including weeks before the invasion, a massive worldwide protest. So if you remember, I think it was in March, all around the world, the streets filled with demonstrators, like, I mean, from like Melbourne to, you know, Dublin. I mean, on a single day, massive demonstrations against the U.S. invasion. Right. And it just didn't, it wasn't even like a speed bump for them. Like, they just went and did it anyway. And so I really feel like grassroots mobilization, it's important as a kind of sort of like atmosphere. Like there needs to sort of like be evident public support for reformism, mm-hmm. but there's no substitute for leadership, reformist leadership in government, in formal positions of power. I don't see grassroots. I haven't seen any effectiveness of grassroots in recent times.
So then how do you initiate that change? I mean, do you try to just join like think tanks and kind of other institutions? And I mean, that's the way to go, I guess.
I'm convinced that it on foreign policy, certainly. And I think other area, I don't want to sort of like on how do you change it on immigration policy? I think there's ways to sort of like do that through electoral politics or elective politics. On foreign policy, it's really important that strong ideas make their way to decision makers. And there's an entire industry in Washington of think tanks that do this. The Quincy Institute is one. The American Enterprise Institute is another one. The Brookings Institution is another one. I mean, there's dozens, literally dozens of these.
Which things. Is a horrifying implication because you look at who's funding things like the AEI, the American Enterprise Institute. And I mean, it's fucking weapons contractors. So how can you even compete with that, right?
It's not a good system, but there are... Look, there's a number of good ones too. You know what I mean? Like there's, you know, where that are not enmeshed, you know, in this funding of foreign governments and weapons contractors. Yeah. And so I think it really be also academic institutions have a role to play too. So people sort of like who are doing, you know, serious research on governance and political science and foreign policy. So there are ideas, policy, like strong policy prescriptions that move away from militarism, communicating those in a persuasive way to policymakers and to elected officials in Congress is, I'm convinced, the best way to bring about reformism. On foreign policy, on other issue areas, it's different, you know, but on foreign policy, like on energy and stuff, like I think you need a different process. But on foreign policy, that's the most important way to go.
Mm-hmm. What about the, you know, like the media being a, like the New York Times, you know, if you join the New York Times, you know, before the Iraq war or something, Christ. You know, I mean, basically the media was in more or less full support.
Lockstep. Of that. Yeah, New York Times never got their shit like punished for their complete complicit reporting on empowering the Iraq war. There's never any sort of like discussion around that. Sorry, Devon.
I'm not a big believer in the power of the media to be a positive force for change.
they're so powerful though. I mean, and not just like mainstream media, but now also alternative media. Like, I mean, having a popular YouTube channel, you know, is, I mean, like Joe Rogan's reaching, he reached 100 million plus people just on his YouTube. It's possible. I mean, 100 million people, you know, you only need to convince like couple hundred thousand in swing states. I mean, that's not unreasonable. So if you don't have much hope in the media, then you know, I don't know where we go from there.
Would the Iraq war have happened if we had the Joe Rogan podcast in 2003?
So it's true. There's no, I mean, the sort of like the collapse of media institutions and sort of like the splintering of the media landscape, I think is just it's fundamentally bad for keeping a public informed about public policy issues. It creates too much misinformation and too much faulty information. Yeah. You know? So there's lies and conspiracy theories, and then there's just like bad information. It's not a lie, but it's just like not well considered. And, you know, and so I think that it's just not a great way to consume information. There's a few good institutions out there still. So, I mean, I consume most of my news from the Associated Press. You know, my wife is a journalist at ProPublica. They do great work. I read the New York Times occasionally, but there's other places out there that I think you can find reliable sources of information. But I would say that given in my mind, the collapse of the media landscape is more of a cause for investing in the education system and then trying to figure out sort of like how to fix the media. Because look, I've been in media I was in the media industry for 10 years and I've been continuing to do journalistic writing for almost 20 years, although I sort of like part-time as a professor and then full-time as a journalist in early in my career. And I'm just not a big believer that you can sort of remake what has been broken, right? When sort of like when the fourth estate really sort of like, well, had a lot of, I don't want to sort of like, you know, like lionize the old days of journalism because there was plenty of problems. But, you know, there was a time when there was a lot more public trust in media. And then I think on the whole, I would characterize it as being a lot more trustworthy. And so I don't think you can go back to that. And so I think you got to find a way for a society to process knowledge and information. And I think that the responsibility for that is really in the education systems at this point.
Which, I mean, that's an entirely different spectrum of bullshit that would probably take, you know, 5 or 6 episodes to even start scratching the surface of. The media point is interesting. I've read before that like one of the greatest shifts in media and what made media such an effective institution, at least in the United States, is the fact that it used to be a working class profession. And it quickly evolved into kind of a prestige job that, you know, Christ, like the New York NYU School of Journalism, I think you have to pay like $100K a year or something like that. It's probably a little bit less than that for a degree in journalism. And the question being, hey, who can afford these degrees? And if you can't afford these degrees and you go into work in a newsroom, are you going to be reporting critically on your classmates at NYU who are now, you know, moving on to big law and things like that? So it's lost that like working class foundation of somebody who just, you know, got their journalism training through working at Beat, through you know, some like hard boiled style reporting. And eventually there was like a level of healthy antagonism between a newspaper and maybe like a government agency or something like that. But I'd say that's more indicative of a shift in overall American culture as it relates to class and class relations and things like that.
I mean, I'm familiar with that narrative. I think there's something to be said for that. But I think for me, the process that's when you look at this sort of like the undermining of American trust in media, there's really the main institutions of media have failed themselves. You know, the New York Times and the debacle of Iraq, and sort of like, you know, I can point to many, many instances where the media has sort of, you know, conspicuously fallen down on the job in just in recent decades. Meanwhile, you've got the rise of technology where you have some podcasts and you know, Twitter feeds and the like producing bad information, but then you've got, you know, people like yourselves who go out and produce great stuff.
Stop.
You know what I mean? Like,
we just haven't been captured by the perverse monetary incentives yet.
The second those Raytheon books come calling, we're all on board there.
But I mean, there's good stuff out there too. In addition to all the lies and conspiracy theories, there's a lot of great stuff out there. And so I think really when you look at people turning away from the conventional institutions in American media, I think the institutions themselves are the ones to blame. They haven't been able to sort of appear as thorough as they had once, and they're losing confidence. And so, you know, that's that. You know, it's like if you bungle your coverage of issue after issue, then you lose faith in people and they go elsewhere.
Do you feel when you were reporting or working as a journalist specifically during the Iraq War, kind of very much on the front lines of the global war on terror and the heyday of American neocons, do you feel like your reporting was hitting, quote unquote, the right audiences? I mean, were your articles making a dent in the overall public perception of what was happening in the early 2000s?
So, I mean, you never know when you do this stuff, how much of an impact you're having. So, you know, I wrote for Time Magazine and it had a subscription then of about 4 million. And then the website would get, you know, where the articles would appear, would get, you know, millions per day. And so, you know, there are eyeballs on the content that you produced. And when I was in Iraq, most of the reporting I did talked about how the problems with the occupation were really becoming more severe. And also there was a lot of questions about how much Iran was to blame for those problems, and whether or not the United States should contemplate some sort of retaliation against Iran. So I don't know. I'll never know how much impact we had. I mean, but I can tell you that in the time that I was there, there was under 50 journalists, and there was probably only more about 30 American journalists who were covering the conflict full time. And so it was a small group of us out there. And I know that a lot of us were, virtually all of us were focused on chronicling the severe problems. And I know that public perception shifted. America went from favoring the war to against the war. And then I know two things that didn't happen that might have happened. There wasn't attack on Syria, and there was an attack on Iran. And I believe that the shift in narrative, sort of as the American public began to perceive, should have the fact that the invasion, there were no weapons of mass destruction, and the occupation was a real problem. And that made contemplating a wider war untenable. And so I think collectively, as journalists, I was part of that shift in awareness. You know, any particular one article, I don't know. But I know that, so like the work that we did over the course of, you know, 10 years or so, and my part of it was three years on the ground in Iraq. Right? But over the course of 10 years there, if you could probably get, when I was there, there was about 30 reporters there. Over the course of 10 years, you could probably go down to less than 100. So less than 100 of us were sort of like out there, sort of essentially informing the public about events there. And I know that perception shifted. So did it have an impact? I think so.
We talked a bit about your views on Trump 2.0 in terms of foreign policy, but maybe to zoom out in terms of your closing thoughts, are you optimistic about anything? Are you hopeful? What is giving you hope as you look forward for the next 4 years?
Politically, not much, honestly.
Great, yeah. Welcome to the doomer fall, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to see much hope for anything. I mean, I think that there is, I mean, I just don't know. It depends on what areas. In any of the areas we've discussed today, I really don't see much hope. I think we're going to start to see more and more conflict, more and more military conflict. I'm convinced that there's sort of like worse to come in that regard. I think we're going to see less progress on climate change at a global level, internationally. I think we're going to see sort of a lot more domestic political problems in the United States. And so just not hopeful about a lot. Don't have a lot of optimism to offer. Maybe in, I don't know, the Celtics seem to be doing all right.
So yeah, maybe the next time we'll talk, we'll be on the front lines of some sort of like diabolical war. We can rehash the conversation in a trench somewhere.
Live from Taiwan.
yeah, coming to you live. Yeah.
Really hope not. Really. Yeah. But you know, there's a lot of possibilities for, I think there's strong possibilities for de-escalation of military conflicts in Asia. So I think that the South China Sea problem can be not solved, but can be de-escalated. And you know, beyond that, it's just pretty pessimistic, honestly.
You've done some just real quick. You've done some research on like political violence and predicting political violence in particular, and you've talked about how inequality is a good predictor of uprisings, using the Cantrell ladder as well as a measure of like perceived happiness, which is based on, I think, a sense of inequality as well. Can you speak to that and how we could apply that logic to the U.S. over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years?
So the research and the data that I haven't done much direct research, but I've done a lot of interpretation of data. And so in my interpretation of survey data, we're looking at countries that experience a lot of volatility. So large numbers of protests and frequent incidents of political violence. In those countries, what you find is that even when people are relatively sort of, you know, well off economically, like they're sort of like fairly high up on the economic ladder vis-a-vis other regions, that they're unhappy nonetheless if they live in a world where they perceive a lot of inequality. or they perceive that they're sort of missing something that they believe to be owed. And so a great way, a great illustration of this is the Arab Spring. So if you look at sort of like how the region was doing economically on the eve of the Arab Spring, what you find is that it was doing not so bad generally. Like the economic indicators were okay. There's no reason to think, according to the economic indicators, that there would be massive uprisings across the region. If you were to, based on economic indicators, you'd think that it would happen in Africa, you'd think that it would happen sort of in parts of South Asia and the like. So, but the Middle East was sort of like, according to any basket of, you know, economic indicators, was kind of on par with Latin America. You know, there's no reason. There was a big World Bank study that looked into this. It was a really wonderful study. It was some years after the Arab Spring, and they were like, well, we've got all this data on the Middle East. We didn't see the Arab Spring coming. What did we miss? And one of the key points in that analysis, which I thought was really perceptive, was that in the Middle East, people believed, even though they had sort of like relatively high degrees of prosperity compared to these poorer regions, that they believed they were owed a lot more. Mm-hmm. So it's like, hey, so if you're sitting around in Tunisia and you're like, we're doing about as well as they do in parts of Latin America, I feel happy about that. And they're like, we're doing about as well as they do in parts of Latin America, and we're outraged by that.
Have you seen video of the capuchin monkeys where they give two capuchin monkeys like the same task, and one gets, you know, a cucumber and then the other one gets a grape? And like, so it just, oh, actually, like the first one gets a grape, and then they got the second one that they give the cucumber, he throws it right back at the researcher because he's pissed off. And so it's like, it's very deeply ingrained, the sense of like justice and fairness. So it's no surprise that, you know, humans respond accordingly, I guess.
But something like there's a number of surveys that look at how people feel when they live in, amid high inequality. So even if they themselves have a lot of material sort of security and benefits, if they feel like they're in a world where the person next door or in the next town over or wherever it is, or even sort of like in another country, if they feel like there's a lot more held by other people, then they get mad about it.
We're trying to get our grade.
You know, man. Even if they're doing okay. And we live in a world where inequality is like, sort of like just yawning in every society. You know, there's these massive sort of wealth gaps in so many countries. And so for me, that's a recipe for political anger, protests, and political violence. And so, you know, I see strong correlations between unhappiness over inequality, even in wealthy societies, and political protests and political violence. And the picture is complex, and it's hard to sort of isolate the causal mechanisms. But so long as there's, so even rich countries, there's why, and this is empirically true, this is very clear in the data, right? So there's more and more protests and more political violence in richer and richer countries. It used to be that a lot of this stuff was relegated to poorer countries. It's now happening in more and more affluent countries. And I think that trend is only set to continue.
Well, I suppose, maybe a bit of a darker perspective from a well-informed individual. But maybe there is hope in doomerism after all. Maybe if we just learn to let go.
Hey, Mark, if there's one book that you would recommend for people wanting to learn more about, you know, kind of all these topics that we've touched, what would that be? A book that you haven't written yourself.
You know, I think one of the most perceptive observers of American foreign policy and its relationship to American culture is my former PhD advisor and dear friend, Andrew Bacevich, who is, so any of his books are really, really good. So American Empire, The New American Militarism, Washington Rules, and they're, I would say, just like, you know, if anybody who wants to sort of like listen to a really sort of like lucid and compelling critique of American foreign policy and how it's inextricably linked to American culture, you just can't do better than Andrew Bacevich. And so you can start with The New American Militarism, and then the list goes on from there. And they're very approachable books. He's a fantastic writer. Most of the books are under 200 pages. He makes really strong arguments. And so you don't have to, it's not like you're signing up for like, you know, like Guns, Germs, and Steel or something, which is also a fantastic book. But it's like, And but you're not sort of like in for like, oh, okay, here we are. And we're going to
And if anybody listening wanted to see your work or learn a little bit more about the work you do, you can plug any channel, any website, anything like that.
I haven't done much writing in recent years. I've been mostly focused on nonprofit work. I run an organization that helps immigrants get citizenship. But I've been a sporadic contributor to the Quincy Institute and their main platform, Responsible Statecraft. So that would, if I've written any articles lately, that's where they'd be.
Excellent.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for coming on, Mark. Thanks. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.